Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an Iraqi perspective on the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. Raed Jarrah, an Iraqi political analyst and blogger, joins us to analyze why Iraq, with enormous oil resources and a greater national income than Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan combined, who have four times its Iraq's population, has a lower standard of living than its neighbors. Then we'll examine the political dysfunction in Washington as the House appears ready to reject the compromise to extend the payroll tax cuts for 2 months. Lawrence Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute, who is the author of the authoritative study of the American workforce, The State of Working America, joins us to discuss the implications for working Americans if this tax cut is taken away by House Republicans, who appear determined to protect tax cuts for the 1% by holding an extension of a modest boost in the family income for most Americans hostage to an oil pipeline. Then finally, we'll look into the unrest in Kazakhstan, where oil workers have been on a 7-month strike against a state-owned oil company, half-owned by Chinese interests. William Fearman, a professor of Central Eurasian Studies and Political Science at Indiana University, joins us to explain the source of the violence that has left many dead and damaged the independence celebrations of the 20th anniversary of the former Soviet Republic that has had the same corrupt leader before and since its independence. And joining us now is Raed Jarrah, an Iraqi-American political analyst and blogger and architect specializing in post-war reconstruction. He first gained international prominence as the person referenced in the blog Where is Raed, which was written from Baghdad by pseudonym under the name of Salam Pax. While the U.S. was invading Iraq, Jarrah and his family compiled their own posts in the book The Iraq War Blog, an Iraqi family's inside view of the first year of the occupation. In 2003, he worked as the country director for Civic Worldwide, the only door-to-door civilian casualty survey in Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Raed Jarrah.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly with the last U.S. troops leaving Iraq, this terrible chapter for America is over, but obviously it's not over for Iraq, and already there's a political crisis erupting in Baghdad with Alawi's deputies pulling out of parliament, and a couple of the Sunni provinces want to declare themselves autonomous regions, as do the Kurds in the north. Do you think the country's going to hold together?
Yeah, the country will hold together, but the political system might collapse. I have been saying this for the last 7 or 8 years. I was a very big advocate for a complete U.S. withdrawal. And at the same time, I believe that the Iraqi people will manage to run their country. But the point that I always made is that the Iraqi people will manage their country through this government or another government that they choose. So it's not necessarily through the current political system. There might be another political system that Iraqis choose for themselves. I think both countries, the U.S. and Iraq, are far from seeing the end of this conflict. We will continue to pay a very heavy price of this war from the U.S. side for the next generation and from the Iraqi side from the next generation. But ending the U.S. military occupation is a very important step forward.
Well, specifically, the U.S., I think there's about 15,000 Americans, largely contractors, left inside the Green Zone, and the budget for the State Department to maintain that presence in Iraq is $3.5 billion a year. So there is an ongoing U.S. presence. But Raed Jarrah, when you talk about the Iraqi people getting a new government, this is apparently the government in place now under Nouri al-Maliki is widely despised, I understand. It's quite corrupt. There was a demonstration against it that was brutally beaten down. Is there a chance of an Arab Spring coming to Iraq?
I hope so. I think many Iraqis hope that. Iraqis in general are very tired. They are exhausted because all of the wars that they have lived through in the last few decades. And it doesn't seem like there is enough energy to work on a popular uprising again. But people are hopeful that the current energy in the country will be enough to improve or change the current political system, which is a broken, corrupt, and dysfunctional political system, to change it to a better one.
And if people have no energy to bring about a change, where's it going to come from? And isn't there a fairly strong security apparatus there? And when people demonstrated recently against corruption and an unresponsive, dysfunctional government, they were treated brutally.
Yeah, correct. I think the lack of energy comes from the level of disasters that happened in Iraq. We're talking about 1 million people who were killed in the last 8 years alone, and 5 million people who were displaced. So the level of tragedy is so devastating, and many people don't feel like they have enough energy. But that said, I think the U.S. withdrawal is creating a positive force inside Iraq. People are feeling empowered. They would like to see their country run in a better way, and I think many people will stop feeling powerless, like they have been feeling under the U.S. military occupation. That's why, although I realize that the energy is low, I am hopeful that the next few weeks and months will witness an Iraqi political awakening. More people will be participating in demonstrations. More people will be trying to fix Iraq than what we have seen in the last few months.
So Raed Jarar, again, political analyst and blogger, famous early in the Iraq War for his blog Where is Raed, which was written from Baghdad under the pseudonym of Salam Parks. He also wrote the book The Iraq War Blog and Iraqi Families Inside View of the First Year of the Occupation. What do you make, though, of Ayad Alawi's Iraqi bloc pulling out of the parliament? He actually won the election numerically, but was maneuvered out of running the country, and he largely represents the Sunnis. Is that a sign of a major fissure in between the Shia and the Sunnis?
It is a sign of political unrest. Iyad Alawi is a Shiite himself. He does not represent the Sunnis, as we hear here in the U.S. He represents a non-sectarian bloc called the Iraqi National Movement. It ran on the platform of not being a Sunni or a Shiite bloc. It ran on the platform of being a nationalist Iraqi bloc that represents all Iraqis, regardless of their sectarian or religious affiliation. That's why they won the elections. Now they did suspend their participation in the political process because of what they see as unfair treatment by the ruling parties, by Mr. Al-Maliki and other ruling parties. I think many Iraqis are very frustrated that Mr. Al-Maliki is turning into a new dictator wannabe, many people share the concerns of Al-Iraqi bloc. The upcoming days will be very eventful in Iraq. I think we will either see a reconciliation between Mr. Al-Maliki and redistribution of authorities to his partners, or there might be an attempt to have a vote of no confidence and change the Iraqi prime minister within the next few weeks.
Well, you corrected me on the notion that Alawi represents the Sunni. He's non-sectarian, but it's the only representation the Sunnis have in the parliament, my understanding is. There's no question, I think, that al-Maliki's bloc is entirely Shiite, isn't it?
It is more mixed. There is no such a thing as the Sunnis. The Sunnis are not one tribe or one group that is, mutually exclusive. I'm personally half Sunni and half Shiite. Mm-hmm. Iraqis are not divided based on their sects. There are so many other groups that did run on a sectarian platform to represent Sunni Arabs exclusively. There are other groups that run on a platform to represent Shiites. Most of those groups failed miserably, actually. Mr. Al-Maliki's bloc has both Sunnis and Shiites, but it has some sectarian undertones. That's why many people criticize them. I think overall, Iraqis are tired of the sectarian politics. To tell you the truth, I hate using these words. I don't even like to to hear these words anymore. The Sunni this and Shiite this and Sunni this. It's really aggravating. And this is not how Iraqis view themselves or their country. I hope the next few years will witness rebirth of the Iraqi national identity, where these sectarian divisions that never existed before 2003, that they are forgotten and put in the background again.
Well, I hesitate to use the words anymore in this interview, Reid. So let me change the tone a tiny bit and suggest then that the conventional wisdom is that Maliki's government is heavily influenced by Iran. And as we know, Iraq was one of the few members of the Arab League who didn't vote for sanctions against the Assad family in Syria. And now the Iraqi foreign minister is, I think he's in Egypt now, meeting, trying to broker some deal with the Arab League and Syria for some peace arrangements.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that given that Iran supports Syria and that the Iraqi government does, alone, pretty much alone amongst amongst their Arab brothers, it would suggest that the area in the Anbar area of Iraq next to Syria could become a very important area if the civil war in Syria, which is largely between now, again, I don't want to use the word Sunni, but that's the impression you get, is that it's between largely Sunni and Alawite. So give me a sense of what could happen in terms of a spillover if a civil war breaks out, in full blown civil war breaks out in Syria, and how would that
I agree with your labeling of this narrative as the mainstream narrative. This is what we hear from U.S. mainstream politicians and from U.S. mainstream media, and then that's why I think many people, including myself, became more sensitive to using the word Sunni and Shiite, because the U.S. Mainstream politicians and mainstream media seems to see the entire region only based on these sectarian divisions. Sometimes when people meet me in the street and they ask me where I'm from, and I say I'm originally from Baghdad, and they ask me the first question, are you a Sunni or a Shiite? So how rude is that, you know, like, imagine being asked, are you a Catholic or Jew, when you first introduce yourself to someone in the street. So it is very aggravating that the entire region and the entire Muslim world and Muslims as individuals are seen through these sectarian divisions. I disagree with the mainstream media's portrayal of the conflict in Syria being sectarian as well. It might have some sectarian implications. It is becoming more sectarian with days, but I don't think it is a religious civil war like many of the mainstream media try to portray it nowadays. I think the conflict in Syria will have implications and consequences on the entire region, not only because of the sectarian implications of it, but also because of the political and economic and all the other geopolitical reasons that a Syrian civil war or a collapse of the Syrian regime will cause. So it is very concerning, and I think the Iraqi government is unfortunately blindly following the Iranian government's orders to support the Syrian regime. Many Iraqis are critical of both the Syrian regime and their government support of what the Syrian regime is doing inside Syria. And the people are not happy that their government that oppresses them and oppresses their demonstrations is helping another government oppress their people, which is the Syrian government. So it is a very hot issue in the country, in Iraq, and it is causing more political tensions. I think one of the reasons why Al-Iraqiyya, led by former Prime Minister Dr. Iyad Alawi, withdrew is the rising tension because of Syria. I think that was one of the hot issues that Al-Iraqiyya did not agree on, and the ruling party, led by Mr. Al-Maliki, has been taking, you know, a very biased policy in that regard.
So Riyad Jarrah, again, an Iraqi-American political analyst and blogger, he was famous for his blog, Where is Raid, which was written from Baghdad under the pseudonym of Salam Pax, and he covered the U.S. invasion of Iraq in the book, The Iraq War Blog, An Iraqi Family's Inside View of the First Year of the Occupation. And we're talking about the final withdrawal of the U.S. from Iraq. We know so many analysts, particularly here on the political left in America, have said that it was always about oil. And I think even the former head of the Fed, Alan Greenspan, made a similar statement along those lines. The impression you get is that there's something wrong with that picture, because this is a country with largely referred to as the world's second largest oil deposits. And yet somehow the oil doesn't really get to market in the volume that the country has, and it certainly doesn't trickle down to the Iraqi people. So what's your analysis of what's happening with the oil in Iraq?
There are two reasons why Iraqis are not benefiting from their oil in the last 8 years. These two reasons are the foreign occupation and the domestic corruption. I think that is one of the main reasons why Iraqis wanted the U.S. to withdraw completely, because they saw the U.S. intervention as a war that is meant to control Iraq's natural resources. Believe it or not, the Iraqi Iraq's budget, which is based, you know, almost completely on oil exports, Iraq's budget is by itself is larger than the budgets of Egypt and Lebanon and Syria and Jordan combined. These are four neighboring countries of Iraq. The population of these four neighboring countries is around four times the population of Iraq. And the life quality of these countries is way better than Iraq nowadays. So you can see that there is money being pumped into the system in Iraq. Iraq sells around $100 billion of oil every year. But unfortunately, that money goes to corrupt politicians and to corrupt companies. Iraqis are not really benefiting from their country's wealth at all.
So do you think there could be a breakaway? Because I understand that there are elements in Basra that want to break away and control the oil, and it's happening up in the Kurdish north, isn't it? The Kurds want to have their own access. I mean, they have access, but they want to have their own control over their oil deposits in their provinces.
There were attempts, especially in 2005 and 2006, there were attempts to pass a new oil law that would have decentralized the oil business. And the Iraqis in general saw that as a threat to the territorial integrity of Iraq. If Basra and Kurdistan and other provinces had the opportunity to sell their own oil, they won't have many other reasons to stay united in the country. That's why there was an overwhelming opposition to the law, and it did not pass. So where we stand now, there aren't really any attempts to decentralize oil production and oil. All the oil goes to one central bank account and gets distributed to all different Iraqi provinces based on their capita. So it is a centralized system, and I think, in my point of view, is that it is a better system that has protected Iraq's territorial integrity and ensured Iraq unity for a long time. I don't see any attempt in the near future to change the system or for any of Iraq's provinces to break away from the country.
But just in closing, though, the point that you made was very, very telling, Reid, that the country has greater wealth and GDP than Egypt, Lebanon, and a bunch of other two other countries you mentioned, four of its neighbors, and yet it's not. Its people are much worse off. So clearly, this money is disappearing. It's not getting to the people.
Of course. Well, I mean, you know. Just look at how Iraq looked like in the 70s and 80s. Although Iraq had a war during the 80s, but it was one of the most developed countries in the region when it came to services provided by the central government, when it came to the level of education among Iraqis. Now Iraq is one of the least developed countries in the world when it came to services provided by the government. There is an entire generation of illiterate, uneducated Iraqis. So, unfortunately, you know, it brings us back to the first point that we made, talking about the price of this war. Iraqis will continue to pay the price of this U.S. war for the next decades. You know, these illiterate Iraqis who will become the leaders of the country in a few years. I mean, imagine the level of devastation that occurred in Iraq, that the parents of these illiterate children have PhDs and they traveled all around the world and they have access to, you know, knowledge and like cultural knowledge of their culture and other cultures. And then the next generation will be illiterate, poor, uneducated, never traveled around the world. So there is a lot of work that must be done to fix what happened. I mean, one point that I want to make before we close is that although the U.S. Military occupation is ending, the U.S. moral and legal obligations towards Iraq are not gone. They are not ending. It's not over. I think the U.S. is still must compensate Iraqis to the damage that happened, and the U.S. must hold all of the politicians who caused this mess, they all must be held responsible to what they have done. So the war is ending, but the responsibilities and moral obligations were not dealt with yet.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Reid Jarrah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Again, I was speaking with Reid Jarrah, who is an Iraqi-American political analyst and blogger. He's an architect. He specializes in post-war reconstruction. He became famous for his blog, Where is Reid?, which was written from Baghdad under the pseudonym of Salam Pax. He covered the U.S. invasion from within the country as his family compiled their own posts in the book, The Iraq War Blog, and Iraqi Families Inside View of the First Year of the Occupation. And in 2003, he worked as a country director for Civic Worldwide, the only door-to-door civilian casualty survey in Iraq. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the House appears ready to reject the compromise extension of the payroll tax cut. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lawrence Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute. He is the principal author of the research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Michel.
Well, thanks for having me again.
And my understanding is that the fate of the payroll tax cut now is somewhat in doubt, because even though the Senate passed it overwhelmingly, 89-10, this 2-month extension, now John Boehner of the House has said that the Senate's just tried to kick the can down the road, and they're opposed to the Senate plan in the House. So what do you think is the fate of this tax, which I think, you know, is going to mean a lot to a lot of people in this country?
Well, I don't know what the fate is, but I know what's at stake. Right now, unemployment has dipped recently to 8.6%, but I suspect it'll shoot back up a little bit. And economists expect the unemployment rate to, remain that high throughout the whole rest of the year. And that's assuming that we do get the payroll tax holiday. The reason the payroll tax holiday is important is that by providing some extra money for people, it supports about 1 million jobs. The spending that will result from the tax holiday will, throughout the economy, stimulate it and support 1 million people all throughout the economy. And if we don't do it, we'll lose those 1 million jobs, because those are jobs that are, already existing. You know, that the payroll tax holiday already exists, the spending is out there. So that's what's at stake. There's also at stake the Emergency Unemployment Benefits Program, which is associated with around 500,000 jobs. I mean, when people get federal unemployment benefits after they're unemployed for 26 weeks, which is what the case is now, and they get a lot more weeks if you're in a state with very high unemployment, that not only helps those who are really hurt by the recession, but by their spending, they support 500,000 jobs. So both of those things are really at stake, and extending them for just 2 months, it is kicking it down the road. And, it would be good just to settle it and get those things in place all year.
But isn't it, this is more about politics than about public policy, isn't it? I mean, attaching the oil pipeline, the Canadian tar sands oil pipeline, to it, is clearly a political act, isn't it, on the part of the Republicans, to give them political cover. Otherwise, yeah, they would be exposed to the charge, which is entirely accurate, that they are once again going to the wall, going to the mat for the millionaires and billionaires, because they refuse to have a slight surtax on millionaires and billionaires to pay for the extension of the payroll tax cut. That's it in a nutshell, isn't it?
I think it is. From my perspective, you don't even need to do these things and pay for them, because it's okay if we actually were to cut spending to pay for a payroll tax holiday, then it would not really give much of a boost to the economy, because where you put in spending into the economy with one hand, you're taking it out with the other. So, we're already at, and in my view, an inadvisable policy of paying for it. But yes, now the debate is how do you pay for it? The Democrats wanting to pay for it with a tax on the very wealthy, which is to me obviously a reasonable thing to do, and it's the thing that would least hurt in terms of taking spending out of the economy, because the very wealthy save a lot of the income that they have, and that tax would be paid out over many, many years. So it would not be something that would take spending out of the economy this year. The Republicans want to do more wage freezes and cutting of federal employment. And, I think that is something that will actually hurt the economy, take spending out of the economy. So, yeah, now, the Republicans are, in some views, showing their hypocrisy. I mean, they're for every tax cut except one like the payroll tax, which goes to the vast majority. But it's really not a permanent tax cut, because it really would last for another year. And I think it's also important for people to know that although this means that people are not putting money into the Social Security Trust Fund, that the general budget actually reimburses the Social Security Trust Fund. So there's nothing about the payroll tax holiday that would adversely affect the Social Security system, even though some people like to claim that it would.
So do you think then, Lawrence Michel, that the White House and the Democrats have dropped the ball in terms of turning the screws on? Because clearly this is making the Republicans nervous in an upcoming election year to be so flagrantly showing fealty towards the super wealthy and denying the middle class a tax break when, as you've just pointed out, they've always been the champions of tax cuts. But in this case, they won't give tax cuts for the vast majority of middle and working Americans.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, there, for some reason, the Democrats are blinking. You know, they're unwilling to let the tax cut go away and then have a public fight over who was responsible for it. And they're allowing the Republicans to blackmail them with regard to, you know, things like attaching this oil pipeline to the deal. So, you know, I think at some point, if you're unwilling to fight, then you're always going to end up with a bad bargain. And I'm afraid that's what happens frequently with this president.
And the House, too, though. I mean, how hard are they fighting? You know, I don't understand why they can't make more out of this winning issue.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is that it has to really catch people's attention, and not everyone in the public is paying attention to this. And,
right.
And when, you know, if you really do want to make political hay out of a fight like this, then you've got to be willing to let there be a real conflagration. And it seems like, you know, people are unwilling to do that. And, you know, that's somewhat understandable. You don't want people like the unemployed hurting in January because benefits haven't been passed, et cetera. But when they act like this, they really are subject to blackmail, just like the president was blackmailed on the debt ceiling debate. You know, just because the Republicans were obviously willing to, you know, let everything blow up the whole economy, they then, you know, gave away a lot, in my view. So, you know, it's a bad habit.
So, again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute. He's the principal author of the research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. So, what's happened then? You know, the problem here is, of course, that the American people have turned off Congress altogether. It's kind of a plague on both the houses. The support for the Congress is down to 9%. But I'm just wondering whether there's any way for the public to understand something did happen and something changed there in terms of their ability to work together. And it seems to me a lot of it has to do with the arrival of Newt Gingrich, who's running for president now. And I think he brought to Washington a kind of poisonous, angry politics of no compromise. And then you have also the additional factor of religious zealotry, which by nature is not interested in compromise. So you have a really nastiness there on Capitol Hill. And people that really don't want to, they just want to grind the other side into the ground. So you have a battle between kind of ideological thuggery and ideological timidity and weakness on the Democratic side. That's the way it seems to be to me.
Well, it is sort of surprising how, with the Democrats having the White House and the Democrats having the majority of the Senate, how much of the debate revolves around extremely conservative Tea Party type notions of economics. Sometimes if somebody is willing to really hold to their position, they can, you know, manipulate the other side, especially if the other side is afraid to fight. And I think that's the way I seem to, you know, see how it plays out. And but I think, you know, you have to play it differently. You have to be willing to stand up strong for what you believe. And, you know, it's not as if there's easy to find common ground. There are really, really different visions of what's good for America, what we want, and how to get there from different economic perspectives. between the Tea Party Republicans and the Democrats. And that needs to really be elaborated for people so that they can choose in the next election.
Well, I suppose that's the hope on the part of the Democrats, that we're the adults in the room, we're being reasonable, we're trying to do the people's business, and these other people are bomb throwers. But, you know, there's also an expression in America, nice guys finish last.
Well, the thing is that the media doesn't always report. They tend to always go into a he said, she said reports about how things are. And you would think that there's something dysfunctional about Congress rather than, I guess, in my perspective, that the Republicans are very ideological and wrongheaded and view any kind of compromise as sinful. So it's not really, you know, that both sides aren't willing to try to do something. It's really one side.
Well, that became apparent, I think, in the government shutdown, that the way...
With the debt ceiling debate, yeah. It was absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, and in some ways, I'm glad that they were like that, because the Democrats were surrendering and offering things that I think would be very bad policy for the country. And I think if the Republicans had said yes, they would have gotten 90% of what they wanted. And because they didn't get 100%, they said no. And I think for that reason, you know, we've escaped some really bad policies. So, you know, in some ways I'm appreciative of their not allowing the Democrats to surrender. But it's amazing that the way the media reports it is as if somehow the Democrats aren't willing to compromise, when in fact I think they've gone way too far in offering compromises.
Well, that does seem to be a problem, that in this kind of binary way that the press operates, with thesis, antithesis, synthesis, the pro, the con argument, and then a kind of meaningless mush. And it's difficult and impossible, particularly for, you know, parts of the media that are funded by the government, like NPR, to really be clear about who's at fault. It's a huge failing. But on the other hand, the president does have the bully pulpit. He has the ability. I mean, he did not make a stand on the Defense Authorization Act in favor of the Bill of Rights when that whole thing is being so clearly driven by John McCain and Lindsey Graham for political purposes, to paint Obama as being weak and to force him to keep Guantanamo open and violate a campaign promise that he made. And McCain has gone to the floor just in the last few days, just saying the most outrageous things about the president over pulling out of Iraq, that to me indicates that McCain's lost his mind. He's still so bitter about losing that he's completely lost all perspective.
I think that's pretty much right.
I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but we're not in the Beltway here and where I'm talking to you from. So I'm sort of hoping to get some kind of perspective from somebody that's been a veteran observer of Beltway politics.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me that there's not more urgency from everybody here to address the high unemployment we have. I mean, it still is 8.6%, roughly 9%. And it's not as if the 91% are okay, because there are many, many families have somebody who has lost wages, lost benefits, has their work hours cut back. Many people are unemployed. Many people are underemployed in terms of in a job that's beneath their skill level or working too few hours. And that affects many, many people over the course of a year. We estimate, you know, something like 30% of the workforce will be unemployed or underemployed at some point during the year. So this is really a widespread hurt, and I think the whole issues of continuing the emergency unemployment benefits, continuing the payroll tax holiday, these are things that are vital for keeping spending going in the economy so that we don't see higher unemployment. And what we should be doing is many, many more things to actually drive the unemployment rate down.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Lawrence Michel.
Okay, thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute. He's the principal author of a research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. And we're going to take a brief station break now and be back talking about unrest in Kazakhstan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Fearman, a professor of Central Eurasian Studies and Political Science at Indiana University. He is one of the country's leading specialists on Central Asian politics. His current research focuses on languages and nationality, policies, politics, and social problems in Central Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Fearman.
Thank you.
And of course, there are problems in Kazakhstan in particular at the moment. And this is a country that doesn't get a lot of attention, although it has lots of natural resources, particularly oil. And it is the oil workers who are upset and on strike. And apparently they disrupted a public celebration marking the 20th anniversary of Kazakhstan's independence on Friday. And many were killed in a clash. 13 were killed in a clash. So is this a sign of a kind of Arab Spring coming to Kazakhstan?
I don't think so, not at this stage. There is certainly dissatisfaction among groups, but Kazakhstan is not one of the, it has some important differences from the countries, the Arabic Arabian countries where there have been uprisings. This is a post-Soviet society. And while there is, I would say, growing dissatisfaction among large segments of the population, I think that by and large, most people are not terribly dissatisfied with their status and their economic well-being.
But aren't a lot of these post-Soviet republics notoriously corrupt in terms of one-man rule? And Nazarbayev has been running that place forever, hasn't he?
Yes, indeed. I mean, that, now you put your finger on one of the really key points. Nazarbayev probably would have won a popularity poll a few years ago, and even today probably would do so. Kazakhstan, because of its oil, has had more resources to spread out, and some of those resources have trickled down. But Nazarbayev, we should keep in mind, has been around since before the collapse of the Soviet Union. Nazarbayev became the first secretary of the Communist Party of Kazakhstan, even before the Soviet Union collapsed, and he has remained the leader ever since then. And in recent months, years, the President Nazarbayev has become much more of a, not just a central figure, but almost a cult figure. There have been monuments placed to the living president in the capital, Astana, and in what used to be the capital, Almaty. They've just made a new holiday, December 1st, which is the day of the first president, which means Nazarbayev. He's been given a special title of leader of the nation, and it's really a bit over the top, and some people, I think, are becoming fed up with what has become a cult of personality of the first president. Family and particularly the president.
So William Fearman, again, professor of Central Eurasian Studies and Political Science at the Indiana University. And what about, though, if he has this power and this cult of personality, which sounds like it rivals Stalin's, wouldn't he therefore be likely to have inordinate control over the revenues from oil? What kind of a distinction is there between the Kazakh national treasury and Nazarbayev's personal bank account?
Well, I don't think that we could say that they're all in his personal bank account, but there are without Nazarbayev's blessing to stay in charge of some very lucrative and corrupt sections of the economy, it is impossible. That said, I'd like to distinguish Kazakhstan from some of the other countries in the region, because by comparison with countries like Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan is a country where, despite the cult of personality, there is something of a civil society that has grown up. The press is controlled to some extent, but there are a lot of different sorts of opinions that can be expressed, and certainly access to the internet, although certain sites might be blocked. People get around it without great difficulty, and there's no punishment. People come and go as they please. So I would not like to describe Nazarbayev as another Stalin. That characterization might be more apt in one of the other countries of the region. And it, with regard to the violence that's just broken out in the far west in Zhanaozen, I think it's important also to keep in mind that this is a strike. There's been people gathered on the in the center of a town for 6 or 7 months, and they've been standing there. One wouldn't find that in a country like Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan. They would have been removed long ago.
So there's certainly no analogies with Stalin's brutality and the gulags, etc. But what is the role of the oil companies? Now, Chevron initially went in there in the big oil discovery. Tengiz, I think, is the name of the oil field.
Right.
So what role do the Western oil companies play? Because my understanding is that it's always been difficult to get oil out of the stands in the former Soviet Union.
Yes.
Because everything, the pipelines all went through Russia.
And exactly.
So where does it stand now in terms of, because they've obviously got enormous potential markets in India and Pakistan.
Right.
For oil and gas.
Right. One of Kazakhstan's central problems is how to get the oil someplace that where it can be bought without losing a lot of the revenues along the way. The Soviet economy was set up in such a way that all the republics, as they were called then, of the Soviet Union were very closely integrated. And indeed, it was set up that some of the oil that was, the raw petroleum that came from Russia was processed in Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan had the facilities to process some oil. And yet there was oil in Kazakhstan, another part of Kazakhstan, that was exported to Russia for processing. And so one had a situation in which Kazakhstan had oil refineries, but it wasn't for the oil refineries there. There are new opportunities. Kazakhstan is looking for ways to export oil to China. There are possibilities, perhaps, depending on what happens, with some of this going toward Europe across the Caspian. There's been discussion of a pipeline there. This company where the strikers were, this was a joint Kazakh-Chinese, it was a joint enterprise. So China has certainly been very active, and China is trying to diversify its sources of oil in any way, and Kazakhstan is happy to have a customer, a way to sell its oil without going through or to Russia, at the same time as there's a wariness with regard to China.
Well, what specifically is going on here, though, William Fearman, again, professor of Central Eurasian Studies and Political Science at Indiana University? What's going on with this joint Kazakh-Chinese oil operation that would be such that the workers have been on strike for, what, 4 months or something?
About 7 months, I believe.
7 months.
Yeah.
And one of them is quoted by the Associated Press as saying, we have no rights, we're being treated like cattle.
Right. First of all, let me place this area of Kazakhstan that we're talking about is way out toward the west, an area that is not very densely populated, an area which if you were to take a train from the major cities in Kazakhstan, would take you 2.5 days on the train. So this is it's way out. These protesters have asked for higher salary. They have asked for equal rights with foreign workers because some the companies hire some foreign workers and pay them more than the local workers. And they've asked for the right to organize a labor union. And when they demanded that, there were this was back in the summer, there were, I believe, about 1,500 who were just fired, and there were enough other people, hungry people, looking for jobs, and they were hired instead. So we have they set up this protest on the main square of Zhanaozen, and it's been there for about 7 months. There have been some attempts to get people to disperse, but it was it's been there for a long time. And then came this major celebration. It's the 20th anniversary of Kazakhstan's independence. And what exactly happened is still a little bit foggy. There are contradictory accounts. The official press in Kazakhstan is saying that the strikers and their supporters who had gathered on this main square, which on the anniversary of independence, began to take some actions such as setting on fire a stage which had been set up on this same main square for celebration. And they set up they set that on fire. They set police vehicles on fire. This the available accounts seem to be in sync, that indeed the stage was set on fire and burned down, that police vehicles were set on fire and turned over, that a hotel was also burned down, and that the local government office was also burned down. But how the thing started, that is unclear. The reports I have read so far from the other side say that there was a crowd of the strikers and as many as 5,000 of their supporters at the time, and a police vehicle rammed into the crowd, and that set it off, that they then went on a rampage, setting various objects on fire. The information has been hard to get out of there because they've closed down all the internet coming out of there, and so reliable reports are just not available. There seem to have been some sympathetic other actions taken, that there was a demonstration in the provincial capital of Aktau. There was also a train station where the traffic, train traffic, railroad traffic was stopped by, according to the people supporting the strikers, by in sympathy with them. But the details are still sparse. There seem to be 13 confirmed deaths and 86 people wounded, although the strikers say that there were more. There have also been a number of arrests. Some people were arrested immediately. But I think the reports say about 70 were arrested right after this. And then there was a curfew and state of emergency declared, and some additional 60 people have been arrested for curfew violations. So there have been internal services, troops have been sent in, and right now the place is still has a state of emergency, and there are checkpoints going into the city and apparently a number of places within the city to restrict the movement.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, William Fairman. It sounds to me that there's more to be learned about the Kazakh and Chinese oil company and their treatment of their workers. And, you know, the Chinese had some problems in Zambia with African workers. It doesn't sound like they're the most gentle economic colonists, if you will. But they have built a pipeline, aren't they? Are they in the process of building a pipeline Kazakhstan all the way across the stands into China?
Yes.
So they're obviously going to be a long presence there.
Yes, the Chinese are certainly a growing power and in some way a rival for Russia. The Kazakhs, in some ways, are welcoming the economic opportunities, but the, Kazakhstan is a huge country which some people fear would be an object for Chinese migration, and they don't want to be taken over by the demographic flood of Chinese.
Well, I thank you again for joining us here today, okay. William Fairman.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with William Fairman, who's a professor of Central Eurasian Studies and Political Science at Indiana University. He is one of the country's leading specialists on Central Asian politics. His current research is focused on language and nationality, policies, politics, and social problems in Central Asia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.